think of something that would that you would be interested in that maybe solves a small problem for you, and then just go out there, look for what tools are available, and just jump into it and see what you can come up with. And then I think as soon as you do that, you'll feel a little bit different after it. Like, you'll feel the strange sense of empowerment that, like, oh yes, I can actually make my own things to solve my own problems, and maybe even potentially solve other people's problems to the point where they want to pay me money for it.
You're listening to the Yo Podcast with Rob Hope.
AJ, more famously known on Twitter as @AJLKN, is a mysterious dude. No one knows his full name, and his social media accounts all display the infamous Johnny Mnemonic helmet shot. What we do know about AJ is that he ships product like a bat out of hell. In 2008, he started HTML5Up, a free website template resource that just clocked 12 million downloads. A few years later, he launched Pixelarity, the premium version of HTML5Up, offering almost 100 website templates, all attribution-free, for only $19. This paved the way for his biggest project to date, Card, an online website builder allowing anyone to create a simple one-page website for them or their projects completely free. I wanted the Yo Podcast to spotlight people who are contributing to a better web, and there's honestly no one I'd rather kick things off than AJ. We rap about the dangers of complacency, the good corners of Twitter, his unexpected K-pop following, pricing a SaaS service, and the importance of being offline. Yo, AJ, welcome to the first episode of the Yo Podcast. Where are you calling from, man?
I am calling from Nashville, Tennessee, in the United States.
So what's it like to build things online from over there? Is Nashville a rad place to live?
I mean, I'm enjoying it here. I guess it's like building from pretty much anywhere, especially in the age of remote work, I suppose.
So I tried to look up Tennessee, and all I got was country music, Batman building, hot chicken, and Johnny Cash. Is this a fair representation?
I think you pretty much summed up the entire city in four phrases. So yeah, that sounds about right. But it's a great place, man. It's fine.
So if my research is right, you went to college over there and studied computer science, maths, and psychology.
That was mostly just to fill out the hours so I could graduate. It was fun, though. It was fun.
And is this where you started to dabble in the web?
I started, you know, doing miscellaneous things online that made money. Like, I started out doing, like, template stuff really early on. And I sort of, like, rode this wave where that was kind of a big thing back then. I mean, like I said, I started in college and it started making money. And then I was pretty much like, well, when I graduate, I guess I'll just keep doing this. And so that's pretty much what happened and pretty much where, I mean, I'm doing different things now, but I've pretty much just been doing self-employed type stuff ever since then.
Okay, so you were dabbling in the template world. And is this around the time when HTML5Up came to life?
Yeah, that came a good bit later. I mean, after some of my other stuff started like waning, and I just needed kind of to reset a little bit, learn some of the more modern technologies. Because for a while there, I mean, I was pretty much riding this wave of the older way of doing things. And I kind of like let my skills wane. I didn't really, yeah, I think you get complacent when things are going well. And so that's pretty much what happened, you know. And then sort of like around 2012-ish is when I was like, you know, I need to really get my shit together. So I did.
Yeah.
And I sort of learned, like, taught myself responsive design, which I had never done before. And that's pretty much where HTML5Up came from. Actually, the very first template on there, which if you scroll all the way down, which looks extremely dated, is literally the first responsive design I've ever done.
So I guess this is a good segment into my first real interview question. How did you sleep at night owning a .net domain, man?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't obviously my first choice, but I mean,
was the .com taken?
The .com was taken. Someone was just squatting it. And then what happened, maybe 2 years later, I think, maybe even longer than that, I just on a whim looked it up. And like, I guess whoever was squatting it decided, well, screw this. You know, this is not worth keeping around. And it was available. So I was like, shit, I'm going to buy it. And so I did. But because, you know, SEO being what it is, HTML5up.net already had, you know, all the links and everything. So yeah, so I ended up just having the .com forward to the .net, which feels kind of dirty, but at least I've got both now, you know?
It ain't so bad. So you started spitting out these HTML templates and then launched a sister company called Pixelarity. And this offered support, you know, PSDs of the designs and the attribution-free versions of the templates.
Yeah.
I want to know if this was more a play to slow down the amount of support requests or more a move to start making some proper money.
I mean, a little bit of those things, but because I mean, what I was doing even with the free templates was if people emailed me asking like, well, how do I do this? Or where is this thing? Or, you know, they didn't understand like how some of the code worked. I had actually helped them out over email. I didn't mind. But it started getting to the point where as traffic picked up on the service, I was getting a lot of those. So I was like, you know, I mean, I don't mind giving help for free, but this is taking up a lot of my time now. Maybe there's a better way to do this. And so I was sort of like, how can I put together a service that kind of takes care of that, rolls in the like attribution free stuff, because people were asking, you know, oh, hey, is there a way I can like pay you money so I don't have to link to you and all this, because, you know, Creative Commons. And I was like, okay, well, let me figure something out. So put something together that addressed those things. And then the additional value add was, well, maybe I can just do some premium templates that you can only get through Pixelarity. So that's kind of where it came from. And then the service launched and it actually, you know, did pretty well. So pretty much kept me going for a few years there until, you know, the more recent project Card. So, you know, we can get to that later.
So having spent some time in the WordPress theme game myself, you know, I know how much of a nightmare support can be. So now you have this new bunch of premium, or I can say priority customers. How many hours a day were you spending on email support?
I don't know, it'd be like 30 to 40 minutes a day. It wasn't a whole lot because, I mean, this is one of the benefits of when you build the whole thing pretty much from scratch, you know how all the pieces fit together. Yeah, so like even weird things pertaining to the underlying framework, which like the Pixelarity templates don't really use that much of a framework, but you know, little things like in the source code or in the JavaScript or whatever, I know why I did this because I wrote it. So if someone has a question like, why can't I do this or how do I do this? I'm like, oh, just do this. So it takes very little mental bandwidth for me to really explain how that stuff works. So I don't have to actually dig into it again. I can just remember how I put it together.
So would you say 10% of your day was support and 90% building?
Pretty much. I mean, you could say that that's kind of the same model that carried forward to Card as well. Again, we'll get to that later. But with Pixelarity, that's really where I kind of learned the benefits of knowing all your stuff like back to front, in part because you built it yourself.
Hey guys, this is John from Ghost telling you to smash that subscribe button. Why? Because I'm sitting down with Rob in Yo! Podcast episode 2. Stay tuned and back to you, Rob.
So it's early 2015, you've got Pixelarity on subscription at $19 for 3 months, $29 for 6, or $49 for 12. Was this covering the Nashville lifestyle?
Oh, easily. I mean, the thing I actually have a pretty sizable Twitter thread from a while ago where I try to explain to people like, look, don't look at what I'm doing and what I'm charging as like a metric for how sustainable running something like this may be for you. Because before I did even HTML5 up, I mean, I made decent money online, you know, with just random websites that, you know, had ad revenue and things like that. Those are all long gone, but I made some good financial decisions and I had a good kind of head start because my parents didn't mind me staying a little bit longer at their house before I moved out when I started doing this stuff. So I could save a lot of money. Like my living situation was good. I had kind of the things kind of lined up really well for me. So it's not like Pixelarity was the only money I had. I mean, I had a good bit saved even prior to that. So, I mean, again, it's trying to keep it in perspective, because that way, you know, I don't want people thinking, oh, wow, so I could just charge $19 a year and, you know, live a very like comfortable lifestyle.
Understood, man. So that sets up the deeper question quite well. So you're chilling in Nashville, you know, more than enough income to order some hot chicken at a country music gig. And in my experience, that's quite a dangerous place to be.
Yeah.
Did this complacency kick off the challenge to tackle something like COD?
Interestingly, no, because what happened was prior to HTML5 up, even when I made, you know, all the money off like doing ad stuff and whatnot, that's when I actually had my little streak of being complacent for like a couple of years when I was just kind of coasting. It's just like, well, money's good, like good enough at least. I didn't have to work very hard. You know, it was like the only work I had to do was very kind of just keep the momentum going, which, you know, if a ball's rolling downhill, you don't have to really do much to it. It's the problem is when that ball reaches a plateau or starts hitting, you know, uphill parts, or like it stops rolling on its own, then you start having issues. And so for 2 years, I didn't have to deal with any of that. It was just things kept going well. And I just kind of sat around and did fuck all pretty much. Like it was not, you think it sounds like a great thing. It's like, wow, so I'm making good money doing pretty much nothing.
Man, it's so classic, because you look back on those easy money years and those weren't your best years at all.
No, because you feel like shit because you're not being productive. You're just kind of like, well, at some point, you know, once your basic needs are met, I guess there are only so many video games you can play. And I wasn't playing competitively. I was just, you know, derping around. So what value was there in those 2 years? Maybe 3 years ago.
So what kicked off the motivation for COD then?
Well, having been through the whole, you know, being a moron who was complacent as soon as Pixlarity, I kind of reached the extent of where I wanted to take Pixlarity at the time, I was like, all right, now it's time for something else. So it was very much, there wasn't really even a period of complacency. It was just very much like, all right, what next? How can I push to the next level? I actually have a lot of, if you go to that, themakingof.car.co, and if you, there's a link somewhere in there to some notes I scribbled down, and I think I have some scans of stuff I wrote back in pretty much like early 2015, some of the very first notes that I put down pertaining to Card before it was even Card, really. But it was very much a, just like the thing that preempted that was just the thought like, all right, what next? And so that's when I started like just saying, all right, I need to come up with something that'll challenge me that a bit more than, you know, building templates. Because quite honestly, building a site template, I mean, there's only so much you can do there, right? It's like, all right, HTML, CSS, JavaScript. I mean, it's fun, but if you're in kind of this mode where you want to avoid becoming complacent, you've got to push further than just that. So that's exactly what I did. And then that's where the seed for Card came about.
Okay, dude, that's intermission into a section I plan to call True, False, Maybe.
Okay.
All you need to do is quick fire back either of those three.
Sure. What if they were all maybe, though?
Well, then it's going to suck. Are you ready?
Yes.
Your Twitter handle is at AJLKN.
True.
AJ is not an alias. That's your real name.
True.
But the LKN stands for Leading K-Pop Networker.
False, but damn, that's good. I need to lean into that.
You work more than 60 hours per week.
Maybe.
Photoshop is superior to Sketch.
Maybe. I mean, we can get into this later, but I'm not at all like a tool purist or zealot or anything. Like, I'm just like, use whatever the fuck you want, man. Like, if it works, it works. Like, I'm using Photoshop because I have like decade plus of muscle memory, and it's like, I can't undo that. So that's why I use it.
Your favorite film is Johnny Mnemonic.
Well, not my favorite, but it is up there.
Your favorite band is Daft Punk.
Not my favorite, but up there, so maybe.
Hashtag 666 is your favorite color.
Oh, maybe. It just sounds so immature for me to be like, yeah, man, isn't that awesome? Hashtag 666. I'm so edgy.
The world needs another JS framework.
True. Why the fuck not?
Twitter is your favorite social network, but DeviantArt will always be your first love.
True-ish.
You signed a six-figure book deal to release a hardcover in 2020 of your top 50 motivational tweets.
Oh, if only. False. But that would be... if I could... I'm like, but who the fuck would buy it?
You've been on a roll, man.
I guess, sometimes.
And last question, true or false? If someone said, here is $50,000 cash, but you cannot use Twitter ever again for the rest of your life, you wouldn't take the deal.
True. I mean, I actually do get some significant value out of using Twitter. I mean, it's not true for everybody. I'm still not sure if it's a net positive in every area, but I know within like our space, you know, what you and I do, like that type of thing, it's a huge positive. So yeah, I wouldn't trade that.
What is it about Twitter, man? I personally love it, but it gets such a bad rep. I can only think people aren't using it right.
I think the problem is it's like the worst parts of Twitter get the most attention, or maybe not worst, but the most like controversial and the, you know, the most divisive stuff always gets the most attention. But it's like the old days of like IRC where there are, you know, different channels and stuff. It's like on Twitter, there are different sub Twitters, you know, that no one knows about. And like, if you're only engaging in like negative stuff that just makes you feel like crap all the time, well, then you're going to have that view of Twitter. But if you do like what we do, like the people I know on Twitter in our little space, it's great. Like I learned so much from these people who just out there making stuff or, you know, starting their own businesses, you know, because I'm still learning. I'm not, you know, some kind of genius when it comes to this stuff. I've gotten so much value out of Twitter over the last few years. I mean, part of it also is the fact that I actively avoid interacting with the parts of Twitter that I don't like. Beyond that, man, it's been great. And I think people need to look at Twitter as an opportunity to kind of get deeper into like a specific subculture or niche or something that they're interested in, rather than like this general tool, like social media tool like Facebook. Because I know Facebook is just, it's the product I had no problem with for a long time, but it's just, I think what it inevitably evolved into, because you have a bunch of people on there all like scattershot in what they're talking about, it's not really focused. But if you get into something that is focused, there's a lot more value to it, especially if it's something you actually care about.
I mean, for me, I've been refining who I follow, you know, over the last few years, and I can log on any time of the day and, you know, there's someone shipping something. I can see in the comments on the tweets, you know, encouragement from others. Sure, there's the odd troll. But overall, I think people are maybe just hopping on Twitter waiting for good news.
Or waiting for bad news. I mean, I only follow people who genuinely like put out stuff that contributes to the goal I have for being on Twitter, which is get a nice stream of inspiration for the type of work I'm doing, you know, learn what's going on in the, you know, so-called like makersphere or, you know, product sphere or whatever. And I, you know, every day I get value out of it. So if I had to pay for Twitter, I'd happily pay for Twitter. I wouldn't mind.
So for those not on Twitter, AJ has about 50,000 followers and possibly the biggest product changelog tweet ever.
Oh shit, yeah.
He tweeted on 7th of March, 2016, done, and launched his website builder Cod. And every time he releases a new product update, he simply adds another tweet to the thread, resurfacing the original launch tweet and gets a few more retweets and likes to the original. Kind of genius. Was this intentional or just a lazy changelog?
It was a little bit of both initially. Before I had like the actual changelog, which you can now see on the card site, this was the easiest way for me to announce like new features for the most part. Recent months, I'm only really using it to put out changes that are kind of significant, like significant new features. Early on, I used it for, yeah, to pretty much tweet any change I made or any fixes or stuff like that. But the idea was not mine. I can't take credit for that. I think the first time I saw it, actually, I think I've seen a few people, one of whom was Ryan Hoover, Product Hunt. And I noticed that I think he would routinely reply to a tweet. But I just remember seeing it like, oh, wow, look, it's resurfacing that original tweet. And, you know, giving a lot more context to recent stuff. So I was like, well, this makes sense because if I just tweet out of nowhere, oh, you know, fix this bug or added this thing, I'd have to also give, you know, use up the, you know, the limited characters you have on Twitter to also explain, oh, by the way, this is Ricard, this is this, you know, and Card is this thing. It's like, well, I could just reply to the original tweet. Twitter will resurface the original tweet as well as show what I just put up. So works out really well.
So Card turns 3 on the 7th of March, and I always read that businesses should aim to profit by year 3. Why'd I have this feeling that you were making profit from the get, from being a one-man show with low expenses?
Yeah, I mean, that is exactly right. I mean, it wasn't making a lot of money when it first started, but it was, I want to say after the first couple of months, already paying for its server bill, which was pretty low at the time. So, I mean, it was already in positive territory. And ever since then, it's been that way. But I mean, again, you just said it yourself, by being a one-man team, it really did keep costs low. But that's not, if I factored in how much it would have cost to pay a developer, designer, or, you know, all the people, all the requisite pieces of a team to build a product like this, you would have been in the negatives to begin with.
It's so crazy to think that if you took on investment in the beginning, you know, hired a bunch of people, let's not even talk about having a physical space, how different the pressures would have been for COD. And I know this word gets a lot of flack in maker circles, but being a solo founder, would you call COD a lifestyle business?
I mean, to an extent in that now that COD is pretty much my full-time thing, you know, the people who have to, you know, they get investments and then they have a burn rate and all this stuff. It's like there are, I guess, how you get started with a business. And again, I'm no professional on this. I can only speak from my own experience.
Yeah.
There are just different ways for you to get to that starting point. And if you do the solo developer, founder, whatever thing, where you do literally everything from scratch, or if you have a, you know, even a partner who's willing to eat the cost of their time, you know, not be paid for their time, and, you know, they're basically donating their time to this project that may or may not pan out, that's certainly one way to go. But as is, and I don't have necessarily a problem with people who choose to not do that and also have, you know, investments and then, you know, hire people and whatnot. It's just a matter of how you start and get to that point. They all come with their own pluses and minuses. When you have, like with with the traditional approach where you get an investor or, you know, VC or whatever, you have the benefit of actually offloading a lot of tasks to different people. You're not doing it all yourself. You can launch a lot faster. You can cover a lot more ground. You, as by not doing the solo developer thing, are not saddled with doing mundane type stuff, at least from your perspective. So like recently I've been writing documentation for Card. Hasn't taken that long to do, and I've been doing okay on it, but it's not like, it's not as exciting to me as, you know, adding new features, right?
Yes.
So that's a trade-off you have to make if you do the solo developer thing. If you've got a team, well, you can have someone who can do that for you. Someone who's, you know, really good at copy, can work on it. So, you know, pluses and minuses on both sides.
So where are we now with Card, you know, user and site-wise?
Close to 300k sites now and about 200k users. I don't give an exact number there yet because some of those sites are, you know, what I would consider just test sites. You know, people have a habit when they start using a service, they'll just like build something that just says test and then they never come back to it. So I actually have a kind of a semi-automated way of flagging all that stuff.
So something like monthly active users?
Yeah.
So not to discredit these figures, but a lot of listeners not following you on Twitter don't know that COD absolutely blew up last year within the K-pop community. So if you search COD on Twitter, that's COD with two R's, you'll likely see someone in the K-pop community tweet, "Hey, check out my COD." How wild was this, man?
So it actually has been going on a little bit longer than that. I think mid-2017, I think, is when I first started seeing the first sites that looked kind of like that, where it was more probably like, you know, people in like their late teens, early 20s, you know, even beyond that, setting up kind of more personal oriented sites, and not personal in the way I originally anticipated, which had been like, oh, I'm, you know, a software developer from blah, and I've, you know, these are links to my, you know, all my stuff. It's actually more just like, hey, I'm this, I'm into this stuff, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then I noticed there, you know, those more anime and K-pop theme stuff started kind of popping up from there. And I think it's just, it kind of went semi-viral among that specific community. And then here we are today, which kind of blew me away, honestly. And again, it took me by surprise, because if you go back to my original intent for COD, it wasn't necessarily to go after this. In fact, quite honestly, I don't think I had a very specific goal for what it was supposed to go after. So maybe that's what helped. But yeah, man, it blew up. It's kind of funny in a good way. Like I actually do appreciate the product is useful beyond just the groups of people that I thought it would cater to.
So from a business point of view, do you question what the product is best for? I mean, this would have messed me up a bit. I would have been overthinking this to death. Is this a quality problem or a problem with the potential quality of the actual platform?
To an extent. I mean, that was always a concern. Like, is this all COD is supposed to be, basically a site for people to put up sites like this, which it can be, that's fine. But I think I figured out a while back is that it's important to not look at, you know, a trend like this, because the reality is it's popular among that particular circle of people or niche or whatever you want to call it right now. But that doesn't necessarily carry on into the future. So I don't, you know, I'm not exactly going to pivot the entire business on, you know, to cater to this market, if that makes sense.
So what about making a dedicated K-pop landing page in just say a South Korean language and just try and get the most out of the trend?
I mean, that's the thing, is like, I don't really want to do that, because again, if it's something that only lasts all of, you know, it's okay. So it's been going on for over a year at this point, and so far it hasn't slowed down. So maybe it's kind of reached the point where it's established as a thing in that community. But I'm not going to specifically cater to that community just because I don't know if it's going to be around forever. And also, it's not super profitable yet. I'm also not going to be, you know, dismissive of it, because, you know, this is still a valid use case for the product. It may not have been one I anticipated, but I'm not going to dismiss it. So what all I've done really is I've looked at it and kind of seen, okay, what are some features I can build that would not only encourage some of these users to upgrade to like a lower tier pro plan or something, but also features that will work for other potential markets, not just theirs. So, you know, a lot of things have come out of that. So it's been actually kind of a beneficial thing in that regard.
So I'm going to link to the building COD microsite you published, but I want to talk a little more in depth about pricing a SaaS service. There are essentially five tiers to a COD account, one being free and four being pro tiers with different feature offerings. Did you craft these tiers over time based on feature requests, or thumbsucked what you thought was best?
A little bit of both, I'd say. So when COD first launched, it had and this is anyone listening who's about to launch a product that's free and you want to make money off it, make sure it always launches with the paid plan or something already built in. So you launch on Product Hunt or any place and you get, you know, your initial blast of traction. You don't want to miss the opportunity of having people convert to paid, like right off the bat, because otherwise you kind of lost an opportunity there. Having said that, COD launched with the free tier, which I can get to a little bit more later, but and then also one pro plan, which is it was just called Pro, and it was just $19 a year. And it gave you sort of, I guess you could call them like more businessy features. I mean, you could use a custom domain, you could use forms, and I think a few other things that, you know, I guess free users typically wouldn't need, but people who ran businesses or, you know, wanted a little bit more of a professional presence online could, you know, use a custom domain and whatnot. So launch with that.
When looking at other online website builders like Squarespace, Wix, and Weebly, they all have 4 to 5 pricing options. Is this really where product makers should aim from the start? to, for the lack of a better word, milk the most of their users versus the traditional one-tier plan?
The plans that came about after launch and we had just that single pro plan, those came basically when I started having feature requests and I was starting to look at them and think, if I keep adding all of these features to pro originally, like when I priced it at $19 a year, that felt like the fair price for it. And there's a little bit in that making of thing where I explained my reasoning behind it. It felt fair at the time. But if I kept adding significantly more powerful features to it, at least from my perspective, the $19 a year would feel a little too cheap. Realistically, it would be almost unfair to my end to offer that many features for just $19 a year. And I don't have a problem with a $19 a year plan. So instead of raising, and also I didn't want to really raise the price of it because the $19 felt like a good entry level for a lot of people. So I was like, well, how about I just come up with another plan tier? And so that's where I started, like, especially I think this was in mid to late 2017 is when I really started dicing up the plans a bit more. So that's where Pro Plus came from, which is $49 a year and it has a bunch more advanced features. And then the Pro Max plan, which is $99 a year, which is basically Pro Plus with a bunch more sites. That plan I'm going to probably rejigger into a more official kind of agency level plan now that Card is at that point where people are using it that way. And then in the last year, I actually came up with the Pro Lite plan, which is just $9 a year. And that was, to speak to what I said earlier about, you know, the K-pop users and all that stuff, that plan was actually built almost directly for that market or markets kind of close to that, where you have people who are content with the kind of the free experience, but they wanted some of the limitations removed. So I was like, well, why not just offer something that's cheap enough? Because they're never going to need forms or a custom domain or these kind of more business-oriented features. But at the very least, I can offer something that's like a free plus experience, if that makes sense.
So I know you're pretty big on transparency, and in the past, you were sharing a lot of numbers as COD was growing, but you've slowed down recently, and I'm wondering if you think that it's still necessary to share numbers once a platform gets to a certain level.
I'm comfortable with sharing like a good chunk of like the process of building COD, running it, you know, just challenges I run into. Sharing raw numbers, though, I think past a certain point, I don't know, like, because now COD is at the point where it's pulling in, you know, a decent amount of money each month. It just feels like when it gets to a certain level, it's about doesn't change a whole lot. Like there's not a massive jump or anything. It doesn't feel super necessary for me to do that. And I know some other people choose to do so. I have no problem with that. It's just in my particular case, it just doesn't feel right.
Hey friends, I'm chatting to you from the edit and I'm really digging this so far. I'd love your feedback if you want more interactive sections like the intermission with music, or you prefer that long, drawn out, deep conversation. Hit me up at yo@robhope.com or at Twitter @robhope. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get back to the interview. So sometimes you spend 40, 60, even 80 hours a week, you know, coding away in the matrix. How do you reset and recharge to avoid burnout?
Yeah, I having spent so much time in front of the screen just to do work, I find that the best thing for me to do is spend my free time away from screens as much as possible. So it's a little hard for someone who enjoys doing, you know, computer type stuff. You know, I do enjoy playing video games. I have nothing against that. It just doesn't seem healthy for me to spend so much time working in front of a screen and then immediately turning around and playing video games in my free time also on a screen. So I've been having to like come up with new hobbies in a way that take me away from the screen and get me outside, especially, and, you know, it's just good for the health overall. So, it sounds kind of boring and mundane, but I mean, I've been walking a lot more, biking a lot more, just kind of forcing myself to go outside and just, you know, see the sun, which, you know, we don't see a whole lot. So it's working out pretty well so far.
It's good to get a little sun every now and again, dude. So are you listening to any podcasts?
Not really. And it's not that I have an issue with podcasts. Obviously, I'm on one right now, but it's just trying to keep this separation, because when you work for yourself, there is sort of like this, you know, things aren't as like your free time and your work time aren't as divided or separated as you would otherwise want. And I know that sounds strange because some people are like, well, working for yourself sounds great. You can do whatever you want, whenever you want. But there are a lot of pitfalls from that I don't think a lot of people are aware of.
Yeah, man, I've really struggled with podcasts in the past. You know, I don't have a commute to work. I assume you don't either, but Only recently I've identified what kind of work I can do while consuming them. And you know, when I'm problem solving or coding or even emailing, I can't listen to someone else speaking. So now I just try and align it with, you know, Photoshop work when I'm creating long scrolling screenshots for One Page Love. And I guess what's great about them is it's sort of a passive consumption, like when you're hiking or driving. But when it comes to gaming or watching movies, you know, we have this sort of opportunity cost where we could just be working on that screen time.
Right. I mean, that's exactly kind of what I was saying. It's like when you work for someone else, you have kind of, for the most part, you know, either a fixed time where you have to be somewhere and work, and then the rest of the time it's yours to do, you know, what you will with it. Or if you're, even if you're working kind of on a project basis or something, there's kind of a definite start and stop to what you're doing. You know, there's like more of a partition between work time and non-work time. When you're working on your own product, or, you know, even if you're just working for yourself, period, there's a good chance there's not that same separation, or at least it's not as obvious. So you have to kind of force one into place yourself. And that's not easy at all, because even when you're, you know, in your free time, even when I'm out like biking or something, I'm thinking of work, and I have to consciously remind myself, try to avoid doing this as much as possible. And that actually, there are benefits to that. Like when I'm doing a mundane task, sometimes it kind of, you know, a problem I had been working on suddenly gets shaken loose and I kind of see the solution very clearly. But at the same time, it's like, now I'm working again. You know, it's not easy. Not to be whiny about it, because, you know, being able to work for yourself is a huge blessing in many ways, but there are always, you know, nothing is perfect. And even something like this, you're going to have issues where you just lose that separation, and then your life ends up becoming just all work, or you end up just kind of burning out and being like, fuck this. And then you just don't work at all for a period of time. And then that's really bad for you too.
So do you have a rule about checking email away from the office?
It depends on what's going on. Like if I'm expecting an important email, I'll be a little bit more, I guess, aggressive about checking it. Like when I have my phone, but like, no, for the most part, I'm pretty good about only checking my email maybe like 3 or 4 times a day, but when I'm actually at my computer working. Especially in the mornings, for instance, the first thing I do is actually check my email, because I have to handle support stuff. And since I still handle that through email, that's the first thing I work through, clear out my inbox, and then I'll check it again probably a few hours later, and then a few hours after that, and then probably one more time before I hit the sack.
How many emails are you getting a day?
Probably about 50 or 60. But I mean, you know, some of those are just, you know, just general questions about things. Because even though Card is kind of my main thing right now, I still get support inquiries for Pixelarity. So I have to handle those too. And it's interestingly, like it's actually gotten so much easier since I put that documentation up on Card. A lot of the questions I used to get all the time are now, well, I just don't get them anymore, which is really awesome. I guess that's the whole point.
You can just send them a link to the documentation page?
For the people who I guess they just didn't have take a moment to look it up in the documentation, which is fine, because I do that sometimes too with other services I use. But yeah, I can just send them a link. But for the most part, people I think just have taken to looking at the documentation and kind of immediately getting the answers that they want. You know, who would have thought documentation would be a good idea? This is really obvious, but don't wait 3 years to put up documentation for your products.
So what's your primary email client?
Oh, I just use Gmail.
And is that for everything? I know I've emailed you to at least 3 or 4 different email addresses.
They're all just aliases for like just my main email. So if you email me, you know, aj@card or whatever.
And that handles the support for HTML5, Pixelarity, and Card. One inbox.
Pretty much one inbox, yeah.
Oh, respect. So, dude, I'm pretty sure I subscribe to all your email lists, and you send about 3 emails a year, text only.
Yeah, it's not something I make a habit of. Let's just say that.
So what are you using to send these email blasts?
Well, right now, and it's going to have to change, pretty much I've just been using Amazon SES. Because I also use that for transactional emails. I have a MailChimp account for the HTML5 mailing list, which the only time I ever use that is when I'm sending like a new template thing. Everything else though, yeah, I still use SES, you know, with a custom solution to just email everyone when I need to email them. But that doesn't scale. Like over time, that's just not going to scale very well. And I think if there's one theme for the last 2 years for me, well, especially the last year, is that scale changes a thing into something else entirely. Like it's not just more of something, it's a completely different ball game. And you know, where I was 3 years ago, almost exactly 3 years ago when I launched Card, is certainly not where I am today. And not in a negative way. It's just that the time and growth of something just, wow, it puts you in a completely different place with completely different things that you have to think about, completely different roles. And it's just, the mailing list thing is just one aspect of it. It used to be that the SES solution worked super well. It was just really, you know, it was just an afterthought. It's like, yeah, of course, why not? Now, with the number of users I have, it's like, to send an email through SES to that many people, that could be an issue because, you know, you have sending limits and whatnot. And like, I'm like, wow, what if this interferes with the transactional emails I send out? Like if I hit my cap or something. So it, again, I have to think of a different solution because the scale has just put me in a different place.
I can fully relate, man. You know, thinking back to a time with the One Page Love newsletter where, you know, in way smaller numbers, but it was around about 14,000 subscribers. But the open rate engagement rate was so low. So I did a bit of investigating and found out that, you know, since the list was started in 2008, there were loads of old email addresses not used. So I simply said, fuck it. And I pruned the email list. Anyone who hadn't engaged with the list, who hadn't clicked a link, I think in the last 6 months or 3 months, I removed them completely from the list. And I took the list down from 14,000 to 2,000.
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden, you know, open rates just rocket. I'm only paying for 2,000 subscribers, but you know, the engagement was so high and I just feel like it was a much better play.
Huh, I never thought of that. Quality over quantity, right? That makes sense.
So why send text-only emails and not use an email template? Is it because you got way bigger fish to fry?
Pretty much. And also just, man, people who do custom like email templates, like, man, God bless you, man. That is some rough shit right there. Like, just, it's like...
Ooh, it's so dark.
I know. It's like, what happened here? Like, it's like the rest of the web moved like so far ahead. You can do all kinds of cool shit like what we're using right now to record this podcast. And then email is just like, welcome to 1998. It's like, geez, dude. And like, yeah. And I just don't really have the mental bandwidth. Like when I just need to send out a message, I'm like, I'm not going to spend a week crafting an HTML email that looks perfect. I'm just going to send out text, which to an extent, it almost seems like that's been pretty effective because I can get right to the point. It's like, hey, running a sale right now. Here's a coupon code. Have a nice day. And then I just kind of back the fuck off.
I guess you don't have a content network and you just drop these product bombs in emails saying, hey, here's a new freebie. Check out the demo. Here's the link.
Right. And I think it's just, I think the problem a lot of people have in really everything is that I think they over-optimize a situation. So they, you know, like they're sending out, I mean, again, I'm not an expert on this, so I could be 100% wrong, but if you're just sending an email to let someone know there's like a new template on your site, it's like, I don't think you need to include, you know, pages of text or shit they don't care about, you know, that just runs the risk of that email getting flagged and, you know, thrown in the spam folder. You know, you just stick to the point. You probably increase the odds of someone opening your email and, you know, there you go.
Let's chat about domain names quick. You seem like a dude who doesn't care much for .coms. You know, you own html5up.net, pixelarity.com, card.co, and AJ on a subdomain on lkn.io.
Yeah.
In 2019, do you think .coms matter for the success of an internet business?
Well, you know, I try to be as trendy and edgy as possible. And, you know, .com is just so, you know, so mainstream. I can't do that. No, but in each of those situations, there was a reason why I ended up without a .com. Like HTML5up, we already went over. The .com was being squatted until I was able to acquire it later on. Card, that was, there's a bit in actually the making of thing. Coming up with a name for Card, or just that service that became Card, was like probably one of the hardest parts of that project. And I know I'm not alone when I say that, like naming something you make is such a pain in the ass. And I had so many more parameters on top of that with Card because the URLs for user sites would also include the domain name. So it had to be kind of generic enough so it didn't like stick out too much. And it also had to be short, you know, it had a whole lot of, it took me forever to figure something out. And then I landed on Card, it felt good. And so I went with it. The downside was the .com was taken. So I ended up just making a calculated decision like, yeah, I'm just going to deal with it. And hopefully whoever owns the .com doesn't try to dick me over later, which it turns out the person who owned it was actually very nice. I was able to buy the domain from them for about $2,000, you know, a while later. And then it's just set up as a forward. But as far as like, why didn't I just switch to the .com after I acquired it? The .co feels, I don't know, just almost like, I mean, I'll be honest, it just feels cooler. as lame as that sounds, it just seems trendier than a .com. And also, I guess, having one less character.
So why card.co and not card.io?
Actually, I also go into that in the making of thing, because if you say cardio, you can see why there's a problem there. It's like, that doesn't seem to fit with the what the product's all about. Like, if it was a fitness app, sure, but, you know, that's not what it is.
Okay, second last question. What is it about one-page websites, man? You and me both have businesses built around this niche.
Well, several things, actually. I think the first of which is, so I've been doing the template thing for, you know, even longer than HTML5 up, and I noticed when I would see the sites people would build on templates, I would look at it and be like, you don't need 8 pages for this. I mean, you could have gotten away with like 2 or 3, or maybe in some cases even just 1. And so I was always kind of, you would see this yourself. You go to someone's website and you click like their about page, and it's like this massive like page design. And then you'd have like 3 lines of text right in the middle. And it's like, shit, you could just put this on your landing page and more people would see it. So, I mean, just over time, I saw that and it, you know, always stuck with me. And then on HTML5 up, I think, I can't remember exactly which one I did, but I did a few one page templates, I think starting with maybe, I forget which one, but anyway, it ended up getting like a lot more downloads initially than I expected. Like, it was very popular. And I think maybe there was even a kind of a demand or an untapped demand for just simple one page templates that just got right to the point, you know, not some crazy expansive thing with like a shitload of extra page layouts or anything. It's just one page, stick your shit on there and you're good to go. When I noticed that pattern, I started kind of like, all right, I can lean into this, start doing more stuff in this area. And quite honestly, if I'm being, you know, it's just easier doing a one page design. Like, you're not having to screw with like a secondary page layout or like a tertiary or, you know, whatever you want to call it. You just do one page and you're done.
Remember when we talked about the darkness that comes with email template design?
Yeah.
Have you ever had the pleasure of designing and coding threaded comments in a WordPress theme?
I have not. That's actually something I have largely avoided in my web design development career. So, you know, my condolences to anyone who's had to deal with something on along those lines.
You know, without the threaded comments and, you know, all the blog posts, I feel like a one page is just a perfect canvas to tell a simple story.
Well, on that point though, I think, and this is not, again, I'm not like some startup like genius or anything, but I think why Card has been, you know, doing as well as it has been is because really the one page thing is, you know, the example I used before, a website with an about page with 3 lines on it, but you have this massive design surrounding it that, you know, it was kind of unnecessary. It almost looked kind of abandoned in a way. Most people, I think, okay, maybe not most, but let's just say like put a number on it. Like 80% of people need, you know, if they need a website, one page is oftentimes going to be enough for them for what they want to do. I guess that ethos, if you carry that onto other things, it's like just do the 80% that most people want. You'll end up like saving yourself, like, I don't know, like some arbitrary percentage of time implementing like, you know, minutia features like threaded comments and other things like that, because most people don't need that. So why not just put your effort into focusing on that 80%, doing a really, really good job on the 80%, you know, lean into it and just make it super nice. As opposed to spreading out your time worrying about styling threaded comments or, you know, all that other stuff. Again, nothing wrong with that. There are people who need that stuff, but not the 80% who need a website.
I'm also fascinated how if you give a user 2 to 3 pages, they'll fill those things up. But if you give them a small allocation within a landing page for the about, they're forced to cut down that 3 to 4 paragraph about and get straight to the point. And that's exactly what a visitor wants to read.
I mean, this isn't an original thought. I mean, other people have said this too, or variations of it, but constraints really do kind of bring out your creativity. So like if you're given, you know, if you're drawing something, but you're only given like 3 colors to use, you're going to come up with kind of a creative, more inventive way of drawing something that is actually really cool that you didn't think you could do. But if you have like all the colors and all the tools and everything else, well, you know, you might end up just having too many choices at your disposal. You wouldn't know where to start, you know, because then you wouldn't feel like you're using the right tool to do the thing you're doing. But if you can see right in front of you just the 3 or 4 things that you can use, well, then I don't know, for some reason that just makes it easier for you to do something interesting.
Okay, brother, let's wrap things up. There are a bunch of people listening out there who are itching to take the leap, quit their job, and do their own thing. What little nugget can you part ways with for anyone who wants to start their own card or online business?
I would say the thing to do is start small. And start with something that, actually, I tweeted something to this effect, but start with something that, even if it's stupid, even if it only serves a purpose for you and like no one else, and you may not even make money off it, do it. Just do it. Like, make something that you would be proud of. Like, you really want to get that momentum going that you can actually do this, which you can. The tools are out there now to where you can make incredible shit, you know, without code. I mean, there's a whole like no code movement now. So just think of something that you would be interested in that maybe solves a small problem for you, and then just go out there, look for what tools are available and just jump into it and see what you can come up with. And then I think as soon as you do that, you will feel a little bit different after it. Like, you'll feel the strange sense of empowerment that like, oh yes, I can actually make my own things to solve my own problems and maybe even potentially solve other people's problems to the point where they want to pay me money for it. How's that?
Whoa, that was solid. Bro, what's next for you and Card?
Card is growing on its own momentum for the most part, but there are big kind of areas that I want to start getting into, one of which I think is commerce. And I know a lot of people ask me about that along the way, like, are you going to support, you know, being able to open your own store and all this stuff? And I'm like, yes, to an extent. I think if I tackle commerce next, I want to put my own kind of Card spin on it. So you're not going to see, I mean, I can't get into the details of what I've kind of come up with so far, but let's just say you're not going to see, you know, a clone of what, you know, like a Shopify or anything like that, because I've said this in other ways before, I can't, you know, out Squarespace. Squarespace does a fine job at being Squarespace. Shopify does a fine job at being Shopify. Whatever I come up with for Card has to be kind of a Card-oriented solution that fits kind of the whole ethos of what the platform is about.
Gumroad really comes to mind as a single product commerce solution.
What I'm kind of envisioning is sort of like, not exactly what they do, but sort of a kind of people who want to set up it. Like, when I come up with features, I don't think of like the individual feature. I think of like, well, how does this solve a specific problem? And I know people like, I just want to put up a page where I can just sell like a freaking PDF, man. That's all I want. I'm like, all right, that's good enough for me. I'll figure out some way for you to do that. And so that's kind of like I want to just sell a t-shirt, man. Just a thing that I've made myself or some trinket or something. I just want to put up a page where people can pay me, and then I just, you know, I ship it to them. You know, I don't expect to get thousands of orders, maybe like a few here and there. And I think there's a huge market for that, because I don't think everybody is running like a massive, huge scale operation where they're sending, you know, shipping out thousands of products. You know, oftentimes it's just like, yeah, I might sell a dozen a month or something. So I want to be able to build and I think that fits right in with the 80% of things that people actually need. I think that's within that realm of the 80%. As in, someone who just wants to sell a thing or a couple of things a few times a month, and they want an easy way to just set that up without having to like fuss with like setting up a whole shopping carts, you know, oriented site, you know, with all kinds of crazy stuff. So maybe I can do it.
I can't help but think on this level and how massive email is on a commerce level and how complicated the build could be to cater for those requests from users who want, you know, failed shopping cart reminder emails, automated coupons, and all that noise that comes with commerce.
Right. I mean, that's pretty much it. Like, and this has been a kind of a theme for a long time, is that, look, I have no problem with you. Like, if you say, you know, Card's just not for me. I need more features. I need, you know, like the features of, you know, a Wix or a Squarespace or whatever. I'm like, well, they use them. That's great. Like, there's so much room in so many markets for different competitors who hit different niches and different combinations of features, because, you know, everyone is different. Everyone's needs are different. I think it's perfectly fine to have such a huge range of products that you don't have to necessarily, and when you're making your own product, you don't necessarily have to cater to everyone. Cater to a niche that you can serve well. And if that person ends up growing beyond the niche that you serve, maybe you try, like, if there are features that you can add that would add to the value of your platform, but don't necessarily take it in a completely different direction that kind of, you know, compromises what it's supposed to be, then add those features. But otherwise, you know, be willing to tell them, we can't do that, but I know someone else who can, and then, you know, make the referral. Which, so I've recommended using Squarespace and Wix to, you know, countless people, because while I don't actually like, I'm not super familiar with their platforms, because as I've mentioned to other people, I kind of avoid looking at my competition. I do know generally that they do pretty much anything you can imagine. So that's what you need. I will happily refer you to them, because they can, you know, give you what you want.
Thanks so much for listening to the first episode of the Yo Podcast. Big love if you got this far. All I can ask if you got value from the show is just share it with a friend. And aligned with how I'm trying to create the podcast that I'd want to listen to, at the end of every episode, I'd want an absolute banger to transition me into an excellent day of work. So I plan to end each episode with a different track I'm digging. And I just want to part ways with a little phrase that I've kept close that's helped me through the last year and a half of pretty hard work, is that you need to remember that the only person stopping you from where you want to be is you. So you need to push yourself aside and get going. Turn it up. I'll see you next time. So if you're still listening, you are what I like to refer to as my people. So please email me at mypeople@robhope.com. I got something special I want to send you. Take care. Hope you have a rad day.